Well, Paul was out of his element. Though he had proclaimed himself to be the apostle to the Gentiles, most of the places he had traveled also had fairly substantial Jewish communities. There were synagogues. There were places where he felt comfortable gathering. But then he had a vision, a night vision. And in the vision, a Greek, a Macedonian, a Hellenistic figure, pagan, calls out to him to come to Macedonia, to be with them, to share the good news of God's love. And so, Luke writes in Acts, immediately they took off for Macedonia. And then they go to one of the major cities there, Philippi. And apparently, the Jewish population is so small in Philippi that there's no synagogue. If there had been, we would have been reading a story about Paul gathering and his followers, his friends, gathering at the synagogue. But instead, on the Sabbath day, he and his friends, unable to find a place to pray, go out of the city, down by a creek, where a group of women have gathered to pray. Now, this is not really prayer, you understand, because for it to be officially prayer, you had to have a minion of 10 Jewish men there. So these women gathering were simply coming together to pray in an unofficial service, which was not acknowledged even by the tradition of those who were Jewish. Among them was a certain woman named Lydia. We know a lot about Lydia just from that little sentence that introduces her. First of all, she's Greek. She's pagan. But she is a God worshiper, which means that even though she hasn't converted to Judaism, she gathers with these Jewish women to pray. Secondly, she's a woman. Frankly, Paul has been working among Gentile males, but hasn't had that much to do with Gentile females until now, when there is no other option. He and his friends gather with these women. He meets this certain woman named Lydia, who we learn is a businesswoman. She deals in purple cloth. And the area from which she comes, she's not a native of that region, the area from which she comes is noted for its purple cloth. And purple cloth in the ancient world was for the very, very wealthy and the very, very well-placed and noble. Those were the only people who wore it because they were the only people who could afford it. Which means that she was probably a pretty wealthy businesswoman. As they talk together, she finally decides that she's going to invite these Jewish men, including Saul, now Paul, to come to her house. So she does. She prevails upon them to come to a Gentile house, to stay with her, to eat with her. And when they arrive, we learn something else about Lydia. She's the head of a household because she and her household are all baptized. That was the custom. When the head of the household was baptized, everybody down to the slaves were all baptized, which means that Lydia, this businesswoman, this quite well-to-do businesswoman, also was the head of her own household. Remarkable. They stay there a while with this Gentile woman, and after Paul and Silas get into big trouble, are beaten, are thrown into jail, confront their captors, when they are released, guess where they go? Back to Lydia's house. Isn't it remarkable that a man who had been raised with the discrimination that Paul Saul would have been raised with, to stay away from Gentiles, to actually consent to the death of those who disagreed with him, Stephen, could now throw open the doors of his life, not simply to speak to a Gentile woman to gather with a group of women who were praying, but then, without being prevailed upon, returned to her house. We're only a couple of thousand years behind. 60 years ago, this week, May 4th, 1956, General Conference was meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One of the issues was, should women be afforded full ministerial rights? Now, women could be licensed to preach. They could be sent to certain churches, usually the less desirable churches or those who had no other choice. They could actually have lay delegates come to their annual conference, but they could not be seated as part of the bar of the conference, and they could not vote. And so a committee report came to the General Conference, meeting in Minneapolis. It might be of interest to you to know that the bishop who was presiding at that point was named Costin Harrell, who had been pastor of West End before he was elected to the episcopacy. He began by receiving the report of the committee. The report of the committee was to allow full ministerial rights for any woman who was not married. If you were married, don't even bother applying. If you were serving and got married, your rights would be taken away from you. That was the progressive report. The other report was the language shouldn't change at all. It passed 40 to 32 in committee. So it came to the floor. The discussion was very interesting because most of it did not have to do with the Bible. It didn't even have to do with church tradition. It had to do with the practicalities of appointing women to churches. Would churches receive them? Would district superintendents be able to appoint them? As the conversation continued, a number of people spoke, and I need to offer thanks to my colleague Aaron Racine for pointing me to this transcript, actually. In the conversation that followed, which was very civil, much more so than it is today, I have to say, the various options were explored as to how we might actually give some ministerial rights to some women, but not all ministerial rights to all women who were called into ministry. The first person to speak for full ministerial rights for women, and I'm going to get my notes out. See, you didn't even know I had notes, did you? This is my little secret. I have them every week tucked in my hymnal, and I don't want to get the names wrong. The first person was C. Anderson Davis from East Tennessee, from the central jurisdiction. Now, you need to understand that in 1956, the Methodist Church was segregated. All the white folks were in one jurisdiction, and all the black clergy and folks were in another one called the central jurisdiction. That had been a compromise that came about when the Northern Church and the Southern Church and the Methodist Protestant Church all came together. And so a delegate from the central jurisdiction, an African-American pastor from East Tennessee, was the first person to speak for full ministerial rights for women. Is that any surprise? He knew what it was like to be discriminated against. He knew what it was like to be set apart as lesser than. The second person to speak for full ministerial rights was Ashoka Singh from the area of Bengal in India. He was a principal of a school, the head of school there. And he thought it was amusing that he, from India, had to come to North America to lecture delegates from North America about equality. He said, you know, I've seen this in my country. We acted that way, 50 years ago or so. He said, I remember a story that used to go around at that time, and he tells a story on the floor of conference. He said there was a traveler who came to take a boat ride, and the person who was to carry him in the boat across the river was there, and he asked, the crocodiles here, are they dangerous to human beings? And the person who was to carry him across, the boatman, said, oh, no, no danger to human beings. Occasionally they'll grab a goat or a woman. I think Singh told that story to embarrass the delegates at General Conference for their attitude that even in his country, he said, was at least 50 years old. There is no record of whether they were embarrassed or not. The discussion continued, and for the first time, a woman stood to speak against full ordination. She made a case with two major points. The first was that the deaconesses, who were not ordained in essence with full ministerial rights, but served admirably across the world as missionaries in the medical field, in the teaching field, in many fields. But our deaconesses would no longer want to be deaconesses if full clergy rights were granted. That was her first argument. It was later denied by the head of all the deaconesses in the church. The deaconesses were in full support of full ministerial rights for women. But her second argument I find fascinating. It was already mentioned that if you vote for this, you have to be willing to receive a woman as your pastor, like that was a bad thing. Can you imagine what this church would be like without the women who have served here? The blessing they have been in the past, the blessing they are now? But then she took it two steps further. She said, okay, you're not only going to have to be willing to receive a woman as your pastor, you are going to have to receive a woman as your district superintendent. She was right, wasn't she? And then she played the trump card, or what she thought was the trump card. She prefaced it by saying, as exaggerated as it may seem, one day you may have to accept a woman as your bishop. She was right on all those counts. So the discussion continued. There were other women who spoke in favor of full clergy rights. There were those who continued to speak against. Every amendment was voted down until they got to the very end. And toward the end of the discussion, a gentleman named Zach T. Johnson, a delegate from Kentucky, turned to his much younger colleague, another delegate there named Edward Tullis, who went on to be our bishop here some years ago, and he said, I'm about to throw a bomb into all these proceedings. He got up and he amended the original report by removing a part of one sentence, the part that said only unmarried women could receive full clergy rights, which meant that when that part was removed, any woman who was called and approved by the Board of Ordained Ministry would receive full clergy rights. Someone even stood to clarify that point so everyone understood that is what they were about to do. Sure enough, when the vote came, it was declared that the amendment had been defeated. But then someone calls for a count. And when the count was taken, the amendment passed by 92 votes. Not a huge majority, but enough. In 1956, women were given full clergy rights in this church because one delegate from Kentucky who happened to be the president of Asbury College made that recommendation. Asbury was not a Methodist school, isn't still. He was Methodist, he was a delegate, but they were part of the holiness movement. And the holiness movement was way ahead of the mainline churches when it came to ordaining women. You see, sadly enough, we've been behind the curve on all of these things. When I was born in 1950, we were still a segregated church. It would be 18 years before we officially desegregated. 14 years after Brown versus Board of Education. As I just noted, there would be 6 years before we gave full clergy rights to women. When I was born in 1950, if you were divorced, you could not be remarried by a Methodist pastor in a Methodist church unless you could prove with credible witnesses that the other party in the divorce had committed adultery or, quote, the moral equivalent of adultery, and I have no idea what that is. And I'm not sure they did at the time. If a pastor did, it would be considered a violation of the discipline. That did not change for another 10 years. In other words, you would have to denigrate and malign your former spouse publicly in order to be married again in a Methodist church. Thank God all of those things changed. Now we still don't, though we say all people are of sacred worth, we still don't receive LGBTQ folks as fully of sacred worth. We're still behind the curve on that one. And in fact, I'm going to speak to our General Conference delegation later this afternoon on a pastoral perspective on that very issue. But you know, we invite all to this table. And slowly but surely, the Methodist tradition is trying to live up to what we say we believe. And it takes us a while, and we are behind the curve on most of this. But you see, I think the South has a particular contribution to make here. We are the only region in the country that actually has a second person plural form in our grammar. Y'all. Right? For everybody else, it's just you and you. But for us, if it's one of you, it's you. If it's more of you, it's y'all. So y'all are all welcome to this table, right? Y'all are welcome to this table. But when I say that, when you just say y'all, you don't know if it means you too, everybody, or not. So we even have a fix for that. All y'all. That's right. Clarifies the fact that all y'all are welcome. Now that's what we have said through our history. All y'all are welcome, and slowly but surely we're moving in that direction. And I pray God that I will live to see the day when all y'all really are welcome. Amen.